introduce you to Elizabeth Engelhardt. She's assistant professor of women's studies at West Virginia University. Her book, The Tangled Roots of Feminism, Environmentalism, and Appalachian Literature, will be released this October, around the bend, but soon, as part of Ohio University Press's series on gender and ethnicity in Appalachia. I first came across her work in the book Cooking Lessons, The Politics and Gender of Food. And that is the basis for her talk today, that same essay I read and was very impressed with a while back. We're honored to have her with us, and I thank you very much.
How nice to see everyone here, even though it is right before lunchtime. I thought I would start by giving us a roadmap so we know where we're headed, and then I want to very much invite you to help me make this a conversation, because I've heard myself talk before, and I like it a lot better if we talk to each other. So, the roadmap. Our goal today is to put in our minds two recipes, one for a particular kind of biscuits and one for cornbread, and use them to talk about a particular place, Appalachia, at a very specific time. I'm going to take us a few years back, even then Dr. Jones did. So we're going to talk about the period from 1880 to 1920. And here's how I propose we do it. I'm going to give you not one, but two introductions, one to me and one to this project and what we're going to do together. And then we'll consider the recipes and, in particular, what they have to say about race and class and gender. So, one introduction. I was working on a book, and it was about women and activism and literature. And I was reading all kinds of novels and letters and diaries and poems, most of which haven't been read for a while, some of which probably shouldn't be, some of which absolutely should be, and I hope you'll go and find it. But I started noticing the very vivid descriptions of food, and that's nothing new. You all know that that is embedded in our tradition of literature. But what I started to notice on top of that were some real details about the food that women encountered, the food that shocked them, the food that appalled them, the food they got very excited about, and then the moral and social and political judgments they made based on those foods. And so I started to just put all that in a pile and let it percolate a little bit and see what happened. Second introduction has to do with all of us standing here. I thought I'd tell you just a moment about Christmas in my family. We had, we don't do it anymore because unfortunately we lost my grandmother about 3 years ago. But we would have for Christmas brunch, which started on the dot at 8 a.m., interesting definition of that, but she'd fuss at you, so Christmas brunch, we would have scrambled eggs and grits and bacon and all kinds of other things, but I would in particular make sure that what I ate was my grandmother's biscuits with apple jelly that was, for the most part, canned by my aunt and uncle. When I was 12, my grandmother taught me how to make those biscuits, still measured by me, obviously eyeballed by her after years of practice, all baked in that nice hot oven until they're wonderful and fluffy and just right for that apple jelly. I may know her recipe. I'm still working on my touch, and I have to practice each time I move to learn that new oven. For New Year's, somehow, even though the food, my family wasn't so big on tradition all the time, and so the food changed sometimes, but cornbread was always a part of my New Year's dinner. And my mom seems to have the ability to make cornbread in any pan which comes to hand. I'm not quite so talented. I need the cast iron to help me out a little bit. But if I tell you those two things, you can probably deduce some things about me. When you hear about the cornbread and the black-eyed peas, which I didn't tell you about, but you can just assume them, and the biscuits and the apples, you might place me as being from the southern U.S. If you know a little more about local crops, combinations of apples and cornbread might tell you something about western North Carolina, where I am from. But what I want to talk about today is how two of those recipes, the biscuits and the cornbread, have shifted in meaning over the course of the 20th century. Today they are, at least for Americans of European and African descent, both primarily hallmarks of down-home cooking, country cooking, some of that nostalgia and comfort food. But when the 19th century turned into the 20th, they had a very, very different and very distinct meanings. To some observers, one was the mark of high culture, of modern hygiene, of progressive womanhood. It demonstrated class consciousness, leisure time for women, consumer marketed equipment, and nationally standardized consumption. Want to guess? Yeah, I knew you could do that. The cornbread, on the other hand, symbolized ignorance and disease and poverty. It could be made with locally produced ingredients, equipment made at home, and brief moments of time seized between the other work you were trying to get done. Even at the turn of the century, among certain people, cornbread could be regionally disparaged, or regionally identified, nationally disparaged, not the food that the proper woman was going to be fixing. And that's what I want us to really get into and talk about, because the point I want to make today is that a social history of class and race and gender hides in the different recipes and uses of cornbread and biscuits at that turn of the century. So I thought I'd start with a little bit of background to bring us right back there and talk about that time period, because we were right in that heyday of the progressive era. So there were all kinds of settlement houses being built. The new woman was much on everyone's mind, either thinking that was the beginning of a new and wonderful era or the end of the world. Proved perhaps to be neither. Public libraries were being built. People were really wanting to talk about and tackle adult illiteracy, child labor, anti-tuberculosis campaigns. People were supporting the new sanitary laws, juvenile courts, arguing for pure waters, planting parks in the cities, getting kids out of the cities to, you know, have that mythical breath of fresh air. Sometimes it worked. Famous slogan for the time from African American club women was "lifting as we climb," which proved to be a metaphor for how all of this work should go about. People were starting to help girls go to college. They were working on temperance, and of course, they were working for suffrage. It's a time of a lot of famous women writers. You might be able to think back to a few of them yourself. And many of those women chose to write about Appalachia because it was one of the biggest fads among the literary scene. So you find those hundreds of short stories and novels and poems that took Appalachia as their subject. Sometimes to the good, sometimes in a way that just really put in place some of those stereotypes you've heard talked about and we've talked through over the past couple of days. University education was really starting for women. The women's colleges were opening up in the 1860s and 1870s, but even at the turn of the century, it was still a fairly new thing, getting to be more and more popular, and a lot of those the country just wasn't quite sure what we were going to do with this new generation of college-educated women. But I give you two examples of women from Appalachia, and later I want to read you a couple of quotes from them, but their lives provide case studies for this era they were a part of. One of them was Emma Bell Miles. She came to Tennessee when she was very young, lived her whole life there. Took a break to go to school and learn. It was a fine arts school. Decided that, in fact, at that time she discovered Thoreau, found how much she loved him, but really wanted to live his kind of life more in Appalachia. So she came back, fell in love, got married, was a painter, was a writer, had far too many children than perhaps her body could handle. She had a couple of sets of twins. And lived, unfortunately, in not just poverty, but the kind of poverty where she and her family lived in a tent for a while. They They suffered some setbacks from people in the family having various diseases, which meant perhaps they needed to burn everything that they owned. That will certainly change what you serve your meal on. And she wrote in her letters, in her diaries, and in her semi-autobiographical book I'm going to talk about in a few minutes, about the extreme circumstances of her life. And she talked about her grocery bills. She talked about her life in that tent. She talked about how she was going to manage her garden, even though she also had to manage the five kids who were running around. She talked about how she got increasingly sick, even while she was painting and writing and observing the birds around her and observing the plants around her and writing in collaboration with other women who wanted to capture a piece of Appalachia. She unfortunately died when she was 39 from tuberculosis. So, she herself had a few things to say about biscuits and cornbread, but she did it in this context of her very own personal experience and life. Another person might be Mae Stone, who came to Appalachia a little bit later in life because she was from a family in Kentucky, downstate Kentucky. Mae Stone is someone who went off to one of those women's colleges and stayed there for about 3 years. She didn't actually get her degree from Wellesley, but she entered it in 1884 and came back to Kentucky and was looking for what she wanted to do with her life. She had a good friend, made a good friend named Catherine Pettit. The two of them got together after being invited by some folks further up in Kentucky and really entered into the settlement house movement. Stone was friends and had connections with Jane Addams up in Chicago in her Hull House, but realized she had to modify that for the Appalachian setting, did that very successfully, and came to Appalachia and founded and worked at the Hyman Settlement School for the rest of her life. So she, in fact, lived her life there. She was friends with some of the first and most prominent women lawyers in our country, women doctors in our country, and she wrote and she worked and she helped a lot of women and men in Appalachia. Now, I'm going to say a couple of critical things about her, and I always feel really torn about that because there are a lot of people, and some of you sitting here may be those people, whose families' lives were really changed by the kind of intervention that these settlement houses provided, the education they provided, the kinds of classes, the kinds of opportunities, the new experiences that they had. At the same time, I think that we have to take these archival sources and really look back at them and think about what were the underlying assumptions and underlying messages being sent in this history of our country. So, Pettit and Stone's school often took cooking lessons as their first priority, and it was in that tradition of domestic science, which you heard Fred Sossman talk about yesterday. They were moving one step beyond Harriet Beecher Stowe and Catherine Beecher, because they weren't just talking about how to make women better mothers and better women, they were also talking about how those better mothers and better women would make a better society. But Pettit and Stone came to the mountains in 1899, and they came, this is kind of an apocryphal story, but one that really illuminates a lot about the time, by a letter that was sent from a preacher up in the mountains who wanted them to conduct meetings of wives, mothers, housekeepers, young ladies, and little girls. Lectures and lessons in cooking and homemaking should be made particularly enthusiastic, and then the intellectual and moral features may be made interesting. So you notice the path there. We're going to start with these cooking lessons. And in fact, that's what they did. And as they did that, they really targeted as their first step the staple of mountain food, which was cornbread. And they wanted to replace that with what they considered to be a more healthful, more appropriate, and more civilized alternative for all the different kind of wheat-based biscuits and light bread. And let me just give you a quote from very early in their journals. They decided that they had a real success that day because Mrs. Green and two girls came and wanted to make light bread, but it was so late, we taught them how to make good soda biscuit instead. That was all right. That was a pretty good day. But the very best thing that they really wanted to teach the mountain women to make were beaten biscuits. That was the recipe they decided was the height of domestic achievement. So for instance, you see Catherine Pettit saying she was up earlier than usual this morning to make beaten biscuit for Miss McCartney's luncheon. She and Stone together report that Ida Francis walked down with a pint of flour to learn to make beaten biscuits for her sick brothers. And you see, for other families, they promised to send them some beaten biscuit and go Wednesday to show their mother how to make them. In fact, some people who wanted to deride the whole project that Pettit and Stone were setting out on would call them the Beaten Biscuit Crusade. So I got very interested in this. Are there people here whose families or who yourself make beaten biscuits? Ah, tell me some of the places you're from. Mm-hmm.
And fruitcake, but beaten biscuits, we looked forward to whenever we would go there.
For those of you who didn't hear, she's from outside of Lexington.
My grandmother.
Grandmother, yes. Someone else? Western Kentucky, okay. Nashville? Mm-hmm. Mississippi, yes. For a special party, for right up there with the cucumber sandwiches. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay, so, not to make it work too much there. So what we're talking about is a biscuit recipe. Let me list you the ingredients. Flour, salt, sugar, lard, cold water. Got what's missing? Leavening. The equipment, though, longer list, mixing bowl, blending fork, wooden spoon, mallet, cleaver, rolling pin, biscuit cutter, baking sheet, and, very importantly, a way to regulate the temperature for baking, such as one of the newest, best ovens. And you needed a board or a flat table that's sturdy enough for the beating process, because what we're talking about is not beating it in a bowl, we're talking about whacking the thing, okay, with that cleaver. This is a quote from 1913. This might be my favorite one that I came across, a woman named Martha McCulloch Williams, who says, "For the perfect beaten biscuit, householders, and especially suburban ones, should indulge in the luxury of a block or stone or marble slab and live happy ever after." Be nice if it were so easy. And she was being very nice there because she was encouraging that, you know, maybe this would be a recipe better for that suburban environment because, you know, if you're right up close to your neighbors in the city, they might get a little annoyed with you smacking on this marble slab all the time. Thoughtful woman. So what we're talking about is that you mix this in a bowl, you kneaded it on a board, about 25 strokes, so not a big kneading process, but then you hit it with a mallet on a hard surface, and one recipe I read said 300 times for family and 500 times for company. If you read Catherine Pettit and Maystone's journals today, you might think that those mountain people they were coming across never made any bread whatsoever. An author named Maria Louise Poole, in a book called In Buncombe County, sort of supported that, where she said, she was, in this book, there's two women narrators. She's kind of one of them. It's slightly fictionalized, who came to Asheville right around the turn of the century. And, you know, were stayed in the city for about a day, and then they head out into, you know, what they find to be the absolute sticks, and they're looking around. And she says of one mountain family she comes across, "They mixed a pone and set it down in its kettle by the fire. They called it making bread." She's a little suspicious of that. So, of course, what is happening in Pettit and Stone's journals in these pieces of fiction is that you see what the mountain people are making, which is cornbread. And we've had an eloquent description of all the different kinds of cornbread, so I'm not going to linger on that too much, but I might just list the equipment that you need to make that cornbread. which would be a bowl, a spoon, a source of heat. You don't even really need something to cook it in because you're surely going to have, you know, some kind of pot around or a shovel or a hoe or, well, a hoe you might have a little bit of a challenge, but, you know, you can figure it out, right? Don't need an oven. You can do it over fire. Not real picky. Very forgiving recipe, and it can be mixed in the time it takes to heat that skillet. And in fact, that's what you should do, right? So, for those turn-of-the-century mountain women, though, that choice of whether to cook cornbread or biscuits for the family was really not just a question of what the family preferred on that given day or what you felt like making on that given day. Instead, it said something about class in Appalachia. The biscuit was marking this entry into a middle and upper class status right around 1900. And let me give you some examples of what I mean by that. Pettit and Stone judged those households that they came into based primarily on what was on the table. So they say things like, the cornets are all clean and thrifty. Their evidence of that is they had a good dinner, beautiful honey and whole wheat biscuit from the wheat they raised themselves. They contrast that to some of the mountain families that they, you know, the other people they're visiting, when they say, those people live on fat bacon, cornbread, and a few vegetables, all cooked in the most unwholesome way. Everything is fried in the most grease they can get. And so then they decide they're going to just really get more serious about what their plan is going to be. And they say, our efforts in the line of cooking will be to teach them to make good bread, number one, to cook the vegetables in as many ways as possible, and then the meat in not as much grease. And what happens then is they start to map this out, and then they go that one step further and they start talking about what kind of moral and intellectual lessons can follow once you get that bread making sorted out. And in fact, when you start to look at all these sources, you start to see a continuum being mapped out. Let me read to you from John and Olive Campbell and their book, got his name on it, but she writes a preface where she talks about how she put it together after he died. So let's give it to both of them. The book was, of course, The Southern Highlander and His Homeland. And they say, it is probably safe to say that the main sustenance of many a rural household, a good share of the winter, is fat pork, beans, potatoes, and cornbread, with the addition of sorghum or honey and strong, cheap coffee. Soda biscuit of wheat flour and grits are also used extensively among families in better circumstances. Light bread or raised wheat bread, and then we would extend that a little further to the beaten biscuits, is very unusual. So we've got cornbread available to almost everyone. Middle-class mountain residents, these people are saying, now of course we can find exceptions, but these people are saying, added in those wheat-based soda biscuits. And then financially and socially upper-class mountain residents are going all the way over into the yeast breads and these beaten biscuits. Novel by a woman named Amalie Reeves Chandler Trubetskoy, who had quite a life, introduced to her last husband by Oscar Wilde, but from Virginia, wrote a novel called Tanis the Sang Digger. That's one of those forgettable ones. I don't encourage you to look at it. It's got some truly appalling dialect. Nevertheless, has a really interesting moment where Tanis's boyfriend, Sam, who is from the mountains, who is also a ginseng digger, that's how he makes his livelihood, comes to visit Tanis in her new job, where she is the servant in a household of Alice Gilman, who is the wife of a man who has come to the mountains to survey the new railroad. Alice, almost, you never see her outside of her house, ever. She is absolutely that domestic goddess in the house. And so Tanis has this new job. Sam comes to visit her, and what we see happening is Sam sits in the kitchen and eats honey with his corn pone. Tanis can't stay there with him because she's got to go into the dining room and serve biscuits to Alice and her guests. So out of that same kitchen in which cornbread and biscuits are being produced, Tanis serves the biscuits but eats the cornbread. So So let's talk about that stuff about gender and race, because we talked just a little bit about class, and I want us to make that more complicated, because of course those things are always intertwined, and it doesn't do us much good to just talk about one or the other without putting the pieces together. So the logic of those divisions in that continuum have a lot to do with gender and race in Appalachian culture around 1900. And I want us to do it by thinking a little more about the ingredients, the equipment, the leisure time, and the national standards that are encoded in those recipes. So, the ingredients we've done a lot of talking about over the last 2 days, wheat being a little more difficult to grow in the mountains, the rainfall being making the plant more susceptible to different fungi, compared to corn, a lot less usable food. Therefore, a family that's going to choose to raise its own wheat, like the Cornettes you just heard about, need that kind of large, clear, unshaded field, or they need the security to take a gamble on this plant that might not yield them as much food as otherwise, or they need the money to go and buy it and have it imported, or at least be able to go and purchase it. And I would just point out there that in that decision about growing wheat or growing corn, the research is still a little bit thin, but that African-American Appalachians in that kind of rural and urban Appalachia were often in worse economic shape and thus even less likely to afford to make this decision around the biscuits and cornbread. But also I want to point out that when we're thinking about ingredients, that time and skill that you take to produce either of these foods, corn can be a garden plant, which brings us to that question about gender, right? In a woman's garden could very easily be a patch of corn. She can, of course, because we know there are a lot of amazing women gardeners throughout history, do a good job growing wheat, but it's a bigger decision. And if she is running that household with the 5 children and trying to write and trying to paint, she's going to have a hard time getting that crop of wheat done. If she is working, if she is working in one of the new mills, if she is, as many African-American women were at the time, but also many white women at the time, working as a domestic servant, she has less time to spend outside. And also, we just heard a lot about how the different uses of corn, and I won't go back over that, but if you put that back in your mind, and you really think about what that ingredient would say. Just to offer you one quote, this is from Frances Goodrich, who was in North Carolina, and she started another one, a modification of the settlement house model, where she started an industry of women doing the kind of crafts and work that they were already doing and finding some ways to sell them nationally and perhaps changing what women were doing to fit that national market. But she talks in one of her books about an Aunt Liza that she met who said, "Ever since my old man died, I've made enough corn to do me and sweetening too. The boys, they come and plow for me in the spring of the year. They'd be willing to do more than that, but I believe in working. Then a body has something." So Aunt Liza, toward the end of her life, was still deciding, you know, that patch of corn is very important to me. Okay, so let's talk about equipment, because I went out of my way to point out those differences in the equipment that you need between the two. I'd like to argue that equipment targets women's lives in a very particular way. And even if a woman wanted to switch from making cornbread to making biscuits for her family, she might have had some difficulty acquiring the equipment that she needed to do it. The Campbells found a mother at one point baking pies. She was rolling out the crust, not on a molding board, but on a piece of cloth spread on the table, her rolling pin being a round bottle. Emma Bell Miles sort of echoes that when she says, "I've seen a woman carry water, dress a fowl, mix bread, feed her cow, and pick up chips all in the same big tin pan, simply because it was the only vessel she had. I've seen pies rolled out and potatoes mashed with a beer bottle found in the road." The Campbells just echo that. They kind of put the pieces together, and they say that their experience of, and they took this 1,500-mile trip around Appalachia, and you can go to Chapel Hill and look at all of Campbell's diaries from the time, and then these little tiny books which she's, you know, writing while she's on horseback, and so you're kind of have to jiggle them a little bit so that maybe you can see what she was trying to write. She says, cooking utensils are exceedingly scarce. So she has a lot to say about what that equipment is. And in fact, you see someone like Pettit and Stone deciding that moral and mental strength are encoded in this choice. And so it becomes not just the recipe, it becomes the process of the recipe. So their good friend, Lucy Furman, I know I'm giving you a lot of names. These are fantastic people, and if you have the chance to go and find them, I hope you will. Lucy Furman wrote several novels about her experience teaching in Appalachia, and in one of them, she describes that very process and what was important about the process. She says, a very pretty young woman in a crisp gingham dress and a large white apron was kneading a batch of light bread dough and explaining the process of bread making as she worked. Then, after the dough was molded into loaves and placed in the oven of a shining new cook stove, the crowd moved on to another tent to learn the proper way to set tables to receive the bread. So it becomes this kind of process that you don't just make the right recipe, you've got to make it in the right way. And we might add to that equipment list, you know, some of those aprons, the fact that that not shiny cook stove is not nearly as good as that nice shining one. And you've got to have that gingham dress, and you've got to have that process down, right? And so you see Pettit and Stone then concluding, add to bad air, dirt, and bad cooking, the use of tobacco by men, women, and even children as soon as they can walk and talk, how can we expect good health? And without any regard to the laws of health, how can the people be strong, mentally or morally? We might let them get away with that until you go a little bit further. Yeah, maybe not. We might let them get away with that, but if you go a little bit further and say, well, okay, so how are you going to decide? How are you going to decide if they're strong mentally and morally? What Pettit and Stone did was they decided they were going to judge it by what was right there in front of them. Not talking to them, not having a long experience in people's houses, not even looking at what choices people make over the course of their life, but looking at what they put on the table. But what you don't see is any discussion of how to help these mountain families that they have decided really need to be making these beaten biscuits because that's morally better, mentally better, will make for a stronger society. They don't talk about how you're going to help women make that transition. How you're going to help them get that equipment? How you're going to do something about that capitalist system that might be bringing people into the mountains to teach in these schools, but taking out of the mountains those very products that are then supporting the schools. And when it gets right down to it, it seems to me that the difference between the equipment, between those two recipes, is a matter of local versus imported goods. Barter and handicraft on one hand versus cash on the other hand. So cornbread's bowls and spoons and fires could be created out of Appalachia itself. A little harder to do with the stove, the shining newest cook stove. National currency doesn't have to be involved in that decision. If we turn to look a little bit at leisure time between those two recipes, it's one of those other places where you get a few very interesting quotes between the two. So you look at Maystone's diaries, and she says, one day, Miss Pettit went out to make beaten biscuit for the sick boys while they all looked on. The boys were obviously watching very carefully because they then asked if it was worthwhile to go to so much trouble. Seems to me that was a really good question. Takes a little bit of time to change from one recipe to the other. And if we go a little bit deeper into that, household economies encompass more than the labor of one person. And although many of Appalachia's activist teachers were from the Northeast, Catherine Pettit and May Stone came from downstate Kentucky. They came from right around Lexington. And in fact, there have been some people who have argued that this very biscuit is a Low Country South recipe, the beaten biscuit. And so, it seems to me that the race politics of the 19th century South are encoded into that recipe. As I was thinking about this, I was, for another class, rereading Zora Neale Hurston's Their Eyes Were Watching God, and I came across the following quote. Janey went to see her grandmother Nanny in Mrs. Washburn's kitchen on the day for beaten biscuits. So teaching Appalachian women that they should find the time, their own or someone else's, to make beaten biscuits, in a way subtly supported the racial politics associated with other parts of the South, and of course throughout the United States. And you can see that popping up in Pettit and Stone's interaction with their washerwomen. Because while there were not a lot of African-American women right around Hindman, there were a few, and Pettit and Stone seemed to hire every one of them, which might tell you something about how smart the washerwomen are, because they didn't hang around very long, to wash their clothes for them. And as they were doing that, you find Pettit and Stone saying that, you know, one of the teachers made bread this morning and showed the washerwoman how to make it. That's not the case that that woman wasn't making bread, but she wasn't necessarily making the bread that Pettit and Stone thought she ought to be making. Nor was she necessarily quite bought into the idea that those clothes washed in that mountain stream should be quite as white or quite as starched or quite as fancy as Pettit and Stone seemed to think theirs needed to be. So there was some tension about where and when women should spend their leisure time. Upper class and middle class white women activists were working outside their homes, right? They had gone to college, they weren't married, they were looking around for what they might want to do, and they carved for themselves this life in another community that involved a lot of hiking, a lot of time to sit beside a mountain stream and sketch a flower, a lot of time to teach, a lot of time to have conversation with new and interesting people, but all of which was really happening outside the home, even while they were teaching the people they were in contact with to go back inside the home. So you have these activists coming to Appalachia to escape a domestic life, at least for a while. They're teaching Appalachian women how to bake biscuits, which brings them back inside. You've got to stay by that oven and just, you know, make sure it doesn't burn. You've got to keep your eye on what's going on. You've got to have the time to hit those biscuits 500 times if someone's coming over. And if everyone could make those biscuits, if Pettit and Stone were going to say, this is the way that you judge success, if you switch everyone over to making those biscuits, they're not going to be so necessary in the mountains anymore, right? It's a flawed logic if they want to sustain their job. And staying in Appalachia meant sustaining that freedom for themselves. But it was built on taking away that leisure time from Appalachian women that they might have otherwise had. We can talk a little bit more about that in a minute, and the part of it that I want to come back to is the resistance that you start to see some of the local women voicing. Let me touch just a second about the national standards. You can start to see at this time, and I'm sure some of you have treasures in your family, which are the cookbooks that women started to purchase. You can start to see, if you look at the magazines, this national woman consumer as a consumer being created and marketed to and addressed and celebrated. So you can see these different recipes coming in this nationally standardized way, and you can see these ovens and these newest cookwares and this newest piece of marble, and all of this brings Appalachia together with the rest of the country. Now, I just want to say that I don't buy the arguments that say that Appalachia was isolated. Near as I can tell, almost never the case. But in these recipes, you start to see that really formalize those connections that, in particular, were bringing women in conversation with women from all over the rest of the country. So let's talk about the defenders for just a moment before we stop. Those defenders start to talk about, you know what, I want to hang on to my cornbread recipe on three fronts. They were talking about that free time, which they enjoyed. They like to go outside as well. They had a lot of other things to do. They start to talk about the health effects and the controversies between these two recipes, and lots of folks who might be sitting here who are advocates of organic food and locally produced produce and locally produced ingredients can understand what their argument might have been on that front. And at least in one case, they talk about an overarching social critique that brings those local values back to the fore and perhaps celebrates connections in a very explicit way. That person was Miles. And, you know, in the midst of her trying to do all those different things with her life, she finds time to write a book in 1904 that was called The Spirit of the Mountains. And I want to just read you a quote from that. She says, "It is easier, far, to buy city tools with city money, but the old-time mountaineer never knew the taste of ice cream in summer. He was, on the other hand, never without corn pone and side meat in cold weather." She goes on to mourn to see them buy meal by the half-peck to eat with the invariable white gravy. And she concludes that newcomers would not think the pay, that's the pay that they're giving mountain residents to work for them, so well proportioned to the sacrifice, after all, if they didn't leave when summer was over, and if they stayed to see the effects. Miles is arguing that local traditions, indigenous local ingredients, and a barter economy was more ecologically, socially, and individually sustainable. And we know, you know, she's saying that in this very sort of abstract, theoretical kind of way. You know, one would see with that separation and how she writes it, but it was very personal from her. This is from her journal on the 8th of May, 1915. "I had only cornbread and wild greens with very little potted ham, but we used big green leaves for plates, leaving them in the hollow of our hands, and the children enjoyed it." She's at that point really agonizing over whether her children are going to start noticing how few things they have. But she's finding some resourceful ways to get around that and make it a game. And you notice that cornbread very much figures into how she wants to do that. All right, so I've talked quite a bit now, and I thought we could move into having more conversation is, let me just give you a moment of where, when I first started thinking this, I stopped. I was living at the time in Atlanta, and there were two restaurants that were on my mind. One of them had people lined up for a 3-hour wait each weekend to receive what they called, they called them biscuits. They were huge, and they were fluffy, and they were very sweet, and they were risen. And the other restaurant was only open Monday through Friday. It was in downtown Decatur, and it had cornbread with its 3-vegetable plate during lunchtime. And what I started to notice was that at the one, a lot of Atlanta's transplants, their recently arrived residents, their white yuppies, came for that 3-hour wait. And at the other, there were working class folks of diverse races, and there were that rarest of breed, the longtime Atlantans, lining up for their cornbread. And so what I want to suggest is that gender, race, class, and biscuits might still be entangled if only we look for that web. For myself, I decided that I could eat those biscuits during the week. I wasn't going to stand there for 3 hours. As long as I didn't call them biscuits, I could just call them pastries and I could get away with it. And I would enjoy that cornbread for the other days on the week while enjoying the social history behind both of those choices. And I suspect that my grandmother would approve. He just guessed the restaurants. I'd love to hear questions, but I'd also love to hear your stories of who made biscuits, who made cornbread, how you chose, what else you know about those beaten biscuits. I've heard there are a couple of patents for machines to help you out with that process, which I'd love to see.
Martha.
I have one of those machines, and it's awesome. It's like a great big pasta maker. I mean, like pasta machine that you put it through. Mm-hmm. And the one that we had when I was little was just done by a crank. But in the 30s, in Nashville and Brentwood and Franklin, there was a man that would put a Singer sewing machine motor in one. So the one I have now that I just inherited has a little foot pedal thing. But it still kind of requires someone on the other side to take the dough out. So it's truly an all-day thing. My mother, I just spent a whole day with my mother, who moved out of her house, and I moved into her house, so I got the beaten biscuit break. And we did it all day long, and Mother told me that I had to, when you prick it with a fork, you prick them. Mm-hmm. Mother told me I had to use a Sterling fork, and I hadn't unpacked my Sterling. And
that wasn't the first thing you did?
No, not yet. And my father called during the midst of all this and asked me how it was going, and I said, I think it was okay, but I didn't use a Sterling fork, and he said, oh, my God. So,
well, I'll tell you a story related to that. One of my friends was a doctor in Atlanta, and when she was from Alabama and northern part of Alabama, when she got married, she said that, you know, in her family, the way you made biscuits is you took the tube and you smacked it on the edge of the table. You spread them out. Father-in-law was a little appalled by that. The first thing he said was, well, can you make biscuits? And she described that. And then he said, well, can you at least make cornbread? He let her stay when she said she thought she could do that.
I'm not going to stand up because these people know what I look like, and there's just so much of that a body ought to be able to stand. Ronnie talked to us yesterday about the difference between the mountain culture of connection and the culture of things that was sort of the rest of the country. Don't you see these as being two sort of icons of those two cultures? Because the biscuits obviously required all this new equipment that you had to buy, and you had to have these things, and they become a status thing, whereas the cornbread didn't take anything but a connection to the land.
Absolutely, and I think you can really see that in Miles's letters and diaries. She was very interested in getting out of her house and going about her life, which involved a lot of talking to different women, talking to women's clubs, but also talking to her friends and neighbors. And she found all kinds of ways to get out of the house. She was she didn't have much patience with something that was going to make her stay inside by herself for hours after hours. And so you see her making the cornbread. You also see her doing things like figuring out how to make a solar cooker so that she could start a dish in the morning when she was making breakfast, take it outside and just leave it sitting there while she went about her day, and then go back and finish it up. That's from 1910, which I think points to how that solar stuff is not newfangled at all. But absolutely, she was interested in those connections, and I think that yes, that's very much
Before that, all we just had cornbread every day, and we even have toasted lightning bread, my grandmother called it, on the weekends. My question was, besides the patent biscuit makers, were there specific brands of equipment that Patent and Stone would recommend? Do you find any, say, catalogs or other ways in which people could get these shiny new pieces of equipment?
In their early letters and journals, no. They don't talk about, you know, they had an endowment and took some money from some of the corporations that were coming into Appalachia, but I didn't ever see evidence that any of that were, you know, purveyors of cooking equipment. However, they do, once they, you know, for the summers that they're gone or in some of their fundraising letters, encourage women and men who might want to give money to their educational efforts elsewhere in the country to send cookbooks and to send those kind of pieces of information into the mountains. So I think you could trace it that way.
We have time for one more question.
Hi, I'm from Minnesota originally and have never had beaten biscuits, and I was confirmed Lutheran. However, I have fallen since. It strikes me that beaten biscuits would be something that would very much isolate a woman in the house, in the kitchen, doing a very noisy activity that would preclude communication while she was doing it. It seems to me that cornbread would be much more, you know, much more conducive to nice conversation with your friends and family.
Absolutely, absolutely. I have to say, it's pretty good for getting out your aggression, however.
Okay, one more. Yes, Carol.
No, it's not about liquor. We're not going to talk about liquor. Biscuits are often called quick bread.
Mm-hmm.
You can make a biscuit very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
It's something you can do very, very quickly after you've made a few biscuits and you don't have to use a recipe and all this.
Absolutely.
Beaten biscuits, in my experience, and where is John Edgerton in here? Because I hope he'll contradict me if I'm wrong. Beaten biscuits are an elitist food. You have beaten biscuits at Christmas when you have country ham, and you make them once or twice a year. I'm not aware that beaten biscuits were ever anything that you got up and say, you know, I'm going to go make the beaten biscuits for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
Beaten brick biscuits also were of a period when people had servants.
Mm-hmm.
And women didn't stand in the kitchen and beat biscuits.
Right.
Servants stood in the... And
absolutely.
Once the servants weren't there, you needed a machine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's when you got the machines.
Mm-hmm.
It was not because everybody wanted to get up 7 days a week and have beaten biscuits.
Mm-hmm.
It was because occasionally you did, and the machines came along then.
Right. Now, I'm sure there's someone here who could fill in some more of this as well, but one of the things Pettit and Stone were very concerned about was the safety of the kind of baking sodas, those kind of leavenings that were available to people. And so they seemed to be suggesting that this beaten biscuit recipe, despite taking more time, would be so much more healthy. And so they were suggesting you ought to be doing this frequently, which I think, in fact, didn't catch on, you know, because people wisely said, well, you know, let's make this for a special occasion, but that's about all we're going to muster it. They talk about how it would keep a little bit longer, how you wouldn't have to worry about the, you know, discoloration or the spottiness or the bad flavor that some of the particularly cheaper baking sodas, different salicylic acids and saleratus and those kind of things might impart onto your recipe. And so they just decide to pitch the whole thing and argue for this beaten biscuit recipe. Absolutely, I think you could trace that history of that patent for the machines into that very changing organization of households in our country as we began to move to this model where you had less of a reliance on domestic servants and more of a reliance on domestic equipment that you bought to stand in for that, if you were fortunate enough to be able to do that.
Just a couple of things, lest everyone hate the beaten biscuit eaters. We made cornbread too, hot water cornbread, which we fried, and we still do. But I understand that the origin of beaten biscuits was when people would take them out in their pockets in the fields when they would be riding in the fields and, you know, spend the night in the fields. And it was a practical thing because they don't go bad, I can assure you. I've eaten them. They don't crumble. And you take a piece of hardtack or country ham, too, which would keep the same way. And my grandmother told us a story when she attended a slumber party. She was born in 1887, and the contest that they did, because they didn't have Ouija boards, but this was for fun, they had to make beaten biscuits without a biscuit mallet to see who could do the best ones. And Grandmama won, and she used a baseball bat. So the women were, the white women were also learning how to make them, but it definitely is easier if you've got someone doing it with you. But it is very conducive to conversation as well.
Thank y'all. Thank you. Thank you so much.